Now to a novel for anyone who's ever stood on a beach at night and gazed out across the inky ocean to the lights of a fishing boat blinking out there in the darkness. Do you do this? Do you stand there thinking, I wonder what those people out there are doing? Well, suppose that you're looking at that shape bobbing about on the black ocean and suddenly there are orange lights on the boat and you realise that it's on fire. That's the setup for an achingly good new crime novel called Quota, which is set on the wild southwest coast of Victoria. The author is Jock Sarong. He's done lots of writing. He's a feature writer at Surfing World and Coastal Watch, and he's the editor of a very classy new magazine called Great Ocean Quarterly. We'll talk about that a bit later. But first, let's talk about Quota, his debut novel. Jock Sarong joins us from the ABC studios in Warrnambool on the south coast of Australia. Good morning.
G'day, Michael.
Are there any whales out there this morning?
There aren't. It's very, very rough out there today. I'm sure they're in hiding.
It is whale country, though, isn't it?
It is, and they move between Warrnambool, where there's a really good tourist facility to look at them, and over at Port Fairy, where they sometimes just wander in unannounced.
Which is where you live?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Oh, they wander in unannounced at your place.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spectacle when it happens, and the town sort of moves to the beach, you know. There's a little flag that they put up to let everyone know that the whales are in, and yeah, everybody lines up in their cars. It's lovely to look at.
You mean there's someone whose job it is to hoist a flag, a whale flag?
Well, the great irony of that is that the town, of course, was a whaling town at one stage, so the same alert would have gone out, but for a very different reason.
Yeah, more fatal reasons, yeah. Well, talking of fatal, the way this works in this book, Quota, is that there's been a murder at sea. So a local fisherman, Matthew Lonergan, is dead, and a local abalone fisherman and his sidekick have been charged with his murder. And we learn about this case through the eyes of a very jaded lawyer named Charlie Jardim, who is working for the prosecution. In fact, when we first meet Charlie, he's in court giving a judge a mouthful of well-aimed abuse in an outburst that lands him in jail for a little while for contempt. You're a former barrister yourself. Was there some personal, wish fulfillment in the way you wrote that sequence?
No, the way that I explain this is that any argument that takes place in court is exactly that. It's an argument, but it takes place within invisible confines. There are rules about what you can and can't say and how you go about things, and sometimes they're probably not apparent to outsiders, but two people tussling like that are doing it within these invisible boundaries. And there is definitely the temptation at times to let the human being just take over and to let fly. And I suppose I had imagined a point at which the boundaries might be ignored and that those emotions might take over. So thankfully it never happened to me, but you certainly have the feelings.
Yes, perhaps you got out just in time.
That might be right.
That's what I kept thinking. So Charlie, who's in a spot of trouble because of this outburst, heads off to the wilds of the Victorian South Coast, which is the country we've been talking about, which is the scene of this murder. And this is where Charlie meets Patrick Lonergan, who's the younger brother of the dead guy. And Patrick's been dealt a pretty cruel hand in the game of life. Tell us about Patrick.
Well, Patrick and his brother are orphaned to begin with. And they sit on the wrong end of a spectrum from the very powerful family, the Murchisons, who own all of the viable enterprises in town. They are the inevitable flip side of that prosperity. They're the hired labour. They're the ones who have no capital in the town and who are the downtrodden. And for Patrick, he scrapes a living with a not very successful fishing enterprise. He's trying to look after his brothers and sisters, and he has this older brother who is starting to dabble in things that aren't legal out of desperation, really.
Yeah, well, you do that very well because it gives us great sympathy for people who we might otherwise think of as pretty rough types and members of the criminal classes, but you really take us into their world and we understand how they're all wired up.
Well, one of the things, sorry to interrupt you, Michael, one of the things that's interesting about that notion is that practicing criminal law teaches you that the vast bulk of people who are charged with offences are not bad people integrally. They are people who've had a bad time, they've had a bad experience, and very often they're led down a blind alley in their lives. And that's what I was trying to portray in the book, that there are differences between the justice system and perhaps the codes of ethics or the systems of morality that we all carry around inside us.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because most crime novels, especially American ones, are about right and wrong. And there's, in the classic crime novel, a sort of community sense of what's normal or right, what happens in the clear light of decency. And then out there, there is evil, there's darkness and there's crime. And the hero of the classic story is usually a figure who's brave enough to journey out of the light and into the darkness to solve the crime. But your cosmology isn't like that at all.
No, it's not. And I think we're fed the notion by the media that there are monsters among us, and tragically I'm sure there are, but again, the vast majority of people who encounter the criminal justice system aren't monsters, they're people who've lost their way. And I think that the blurring of those lines, which is the reality, is where the interest is for a fiction writer.
Mm. So really you've written a book that's about the collision of several different worldviews or different moral codes or bumping up against each other. I mean, if I could think about what they are, there's the lawyers with their strange code of neutrality, which you've just discussed about, their kind of moral neutrality. There's the Murchisons who run the town, who are a pretty unsavoury lot, really. There's the heavy-duty criminal who deals in illegal abalone, who's a fantastic character. And Patrick himself, who's poor and tough and, as you say, is looking after his younger siblings. So all these worldviews are actually in play.
They are, and one of the observations that Patrick makes about Charlie is that he has a fanatical belief that the orthodoxies of the law can figure everything out, and yet he's not very good with people. The people in the town, conversely, are very good with each other. They're very suspicious of outsiders, but they're very good with each other. And what they don't understand is this rigorous system of formalities that, as far as they're concerned, just get in the way of sorting out problems.
So let's get a bit more of a flavour of the world you've created. In the centre of the town, which is called Dauphin, actually, why is it called Dauphin? I'm guessing it's because the place was explored by a French explorer, probably Nicolas Baudin, was it?
Very close. It's interesting, a lot of the names for things in the book were private jokes I was having with myself about various things, but my family originally are Portuguese, and I'm very interested in the theory of the early Portuguese exploration of the Australian coast. There is a belief that the Portuguese who travelled down the east coast of Australia were guided by a stolen map called the Dauphin map, or the Dauphin map, which was originally a French state secret. So it's a reference to that, although in writing the book, of course, it's not a verbal exercise, and I never really turned my mind to how you might pronounce that word, and it's something I've been asked a fair bit.
I see. Also, it doesn't make any sense, with respect, because there's no way an Australian place could have a Portuguese name, because there is no place names to give you any sense that the Portuguese ever came here, unlike the Dutch, who, of course, have left us with, well, the Swan River, for a start.
Absolutely right. And if, in fact, the Portuguese were wandering around that coast, they were doing it in breach of international law at the time, so they certainly weren't going to go naming things.
The evidence is pretty thin, Jock. You do know that.
I'll keep pushing my case.
It is pretty thin. All right, so anyway, we're in this town that's, well, Dauphin, however you're going to say it, in which there is the most appalling pub called the Norman's Woe. And I'll just, with your permission, read the first paragraph of your description of it. The first thing that struck Charlie about the Norman's Woe was the smell. Even as a gust of brutish southerly wind whipped in the doorway behind him, he caught a waft of old cooking oil, boiled cauliflower, and something slightly rancid. I reckon I've been in that pub.
Well, I, like a lot of people, on the way through uni, I worked in pubs for years, and I happened to be working in pubs right in those years when the transition occurred from them being smoking environments to non-smoking environments. And that was all well and good because I'm a non-smoker and I'd go home with my clothes and my hair and everything stinking of smoke. But what I found when they became non-smoking environments was that the smell was possibly worse in a lot of instances. So that's the thing I was trying to tune into there.
That's a disturbing thought.
It is.
You mean that the fresh cigarettes were masking much, a much older sort of misery?
Yes, there's a deeper truth under that smoke.
Jock Sarong is my guest here this morning on Books and Arts Daily. We're talking about his novel, his first novel. It's called Quota, The Law of the Sea is Unforgiving, it says underneath the title. And it's a crime novel set on the wild southwest coast of Victoria. It's a wonderful story. I've really enjoyed reading it. What do you reckon a crime novel is? I mean, this is your first novel, even though you're a very experienced writer. So you must have sat down and thought what the genre is, even though you've done so much to subvert it.
It's an interesting question because a lot of the way through the process of writing and editing the book, I didn't believe it was a crime novel at all. And it was a discussion that I had with text publishing throughout. And I think if it is a crime novel, it is out at the further reaches of the genre. For me, a crime novel is one in which there's a traumatic criminal event of some sort. And from there, I think everything else is really up for grabs. I'm not a believer that a crime novel is a detective story. Here, there is a traumatic event, and what I was principally concerned with was the way in which it sets these people in motion, the way in which it sends them down a path. Characters bouncing off each other because their ordinary worlds have been disrupted in some traumatic way. And I think that within that very loose description, crime really is a very open genre.
Yeah. Well, I would call this a crime novel because it starts with this gruesome murder. But what's interesting about it is that we're not trying to work out who did the murder. We know who's done the murder. It's these two violent fishermen who've knocked this fellow off. And the real question is the dead man's brother going to testify or not? Because there are real reasons against him testifying.
Yeah.
And so there's no whodunit element to it at all. But we do feel, as you often do in a crime novel, that everyone is at risk.
That's right. And I think that for Patrick in particular, the drama is centred upon the idea that he has a grasp of the truth. He was there and he saw and he knows what happened. And the system is conspiring to mangle his truth and to slice it up and represent it in other ways. And when he goes to Melbourne to give evidence in the murder trial, he's standing in a witness box, as frequently happens, and he knows precisely what went on, and yet he can't seem to communicate that truth to the people in the room. Criminal trials are a contest between two stories. They're very frequently not a search for the truth. And there's this guy standing there with the truth in his head but unable to communicate it.
Yes, and unwilling to communicate it too. What's it meant to you to write such a vivid story set in the country where you actually live?
I had to think very carefully about that as I wrote because in a passive way I wanted to do tribute to what I could see around me, the people and the landscape and the way in which they operate. And I certainly didn't want to mock anybody or belittle anything that I could see. So I was wary about it, but by the same token, I wanted to really deliver the essence of it. And that is a very fine line.
Well, I love this book for its Aussie detail. And I love the description where you hit the kangaroo. So Charlie, on his first drive down from town, where he's in disgrace because he's misbehaved in court, hits a kangaroo. And it's an astonishing description of hitting a kangaroo. You must have done this yourself, have you?
I did, yeah. And it was a very, very unpleasant experience because there's immediately, if the animal survives the impact, there's immediately a moral dilemma about whether it is right to get out and finish the animal off. And that's what I wanted Charlie to struggle with. And really the way in which I think that scene works in dramatic terms is that it's the mark at which Charlie is separated from the world that he understands. Everything before then, his office and his car and the courtrooms, he understands. But once he hits that kangaroo, it launches him into a place where his ordinary understanding of the world is at an end.
Yeah, well, just as his car is dented out of shape, so his world is dented out of shape.
Yes.
And then he does this thing, which I guess is what you'd have to do. He grabs the, what's it called, the lever from the tyre jack. The thing he used to jack up the car, and he whacks the kangaroo over the head with it a few dozen times to kill it, because that seems to be the only humane thing to do, and it's a pretty grotesque task to have to perform.
Yes, and for a person like Charlie, who really is a great indoorsman, firstly, he doesn't know what he would use to hit it with, and secondly, he doesn't know what it's going to feel like to hit it. And I wanted that to be quite visceral because it's that unfamiliarity that I was looking for.
Jock Sarong's my guest here on Books and Arts Daily this morning. Jock, at a time when everyone seems to be trying to work out how to make money online, you've done something very old-fashioned. You've started to publish a magazine. And I think, are we up to number 4?
We are, yes.
So I bought the first one and I've been looking at them ever since. And I love your magazine. Tell us about it. What's the organising principle of it?
It is the ocean. And once we started to collect material about the ocean, what we discovered was that we were probably making a magazine about people and the way in which they relate to the ocean. So it gathers art and photography and poetry and fiction and science and history and dozens of other things, all of them around this organising principle of the ocean. And one of the ideas that we started with was that people often attach labels to themselves, that they might be surfers or divers, fishermen or kayakers or whatever it is, even bird watchers, but that really all of those people are going to the ocean seeking a similar feeling. And if you can introduce a person via their particular interest, they will also keep reading because what they're really interested in is the ocean, and ultimately it's unknowable. So there's no real limit to the number of different topics you can talk about.
Well, congratulations on a terrific magazine and a wonderful first novel. It's been wonderful to have you on the show, Jock.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Jock Sarong. His novel is called Quota. It's published by Text, and I really do recommend it. I loved reading it. And he's also the editor of Great Ocean Quarterly, a very classy magazine with fabulous photos of surf and coastal life and lots of lovely writing as well. Across Australia, this is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily.